Welcome to North Square Investments Active Insights Podcast. North Square Investments is dedicated to bringing differentiated active investment strategies to financial advisors and investors through our multi-boutique asset management platform. Today, Mark Goodwin, Chief Executive Officer of North Square Investments, will discuss large cap equity investing with C.S. McKee Portfolio Managers Mary Jane Matz, Ted Moore, and Graham Harkins. C.S. McKee is a partner firm in the North Square platform and manages the Large Cap Value Portfolio, which is a separately managed account investment strategy offered by North Square. Mark, MJ, Ted, and Graham, we look forward to your discussion.
Thanks, Diane. As you mentioned, at North Square, we seek out best-in-class active managers for our platform, and our partners at C.S. McKee provide value-oriented equity strategies from microcap to large caps. MJ, starting with you, can you discuss the key elements to your approach to managing large cap equity portfolios and also discuss the main driver of performance?
Yes, Mark, thanks. You know, in the large cap space, each of us on the team function as research analysts / portfolio managers doing bottom-up fundamental research on our sectors. And at the heart of our approach is an assessment of fair value, which is driven by that fundamental effort. But to quickly and efficiently process a large amount of data and compare stocks across a wide variety of sectors, we utilize a toolkit of modern quantitative techniques. So in a way, our approach might be best described as quantamental, a marriage of bottom-up fundamental analysis with sophisticated quantitative techniques. The vast majority of the risk and return in the portfolio is driven by stock selection as opposed to sector weight decisions or style deviations from the benchmark. That's where the bulk of our effort goes, and over time, that's the leading driver of performance.
Thanks for that. I want to focus on the large cap value strategy right now. MJ, there are almost 900 stocks in your benchmark Russell 1000 Value Index. What characteristics are you looking for in order for a stock to become a position in your portfolio?
Right, Mark. The universe is broad, but we're looking for an elusive combination of three factors that make a stock look attractive to us. First is statistical cheapness, second is undervaluation, and third is timeliness. In terms of statistical cheapness, that describes us starting with a fishing pond of consistently underpriced stocks that represent neglected, out-of-favor stocks that are trading at lower than average multiples of earnings, book value, cash flow, dividend yield. Those are stocks that are cheap on a price-to-pound basis, but many of those stocks deserve to be cheap, either because their growth prospects are so poor or their risk is so high that it isn't until we can do a valuation exercise that we can begin to distinguish between those that are merely cheap and those that are truly undervalued, that being the second leg of the stool. Thirdly, we know the chief pitfall of this style of investing is being right about the value on paper, but being too early and having to wait too long for the market to realize that value. So to endeavor to avoid situations that become value traps, we use a number of timeliness tools to identify a situation where investor sentiment is actually beginning to improve. So those are the three main elements: statistical cheapness, valuation, and timeliness that drive us to a 40 to 60 stock portfolio of attractive names.
That's a great summary. Ted, turning to you, your portfolio is relatively concentrated with a 40 to 60 stocks, as we talked about. How do you consider risk management as you build a portfolio?
Thank you, Mark. Yes, it is a concentrated portfolio with roughly 50 names and no single position over 5%. Regarding risk management, we closely track our level of active risk versus the benchmark, as well as its composition, which typically breaks down to roughly 70% stock-specific risk, with another 15% each attributed to sector and style. We consciously budget our risk via position sizing such that our highest conviction holdings contribute most significantly to active risk. And we monitor the sector and style factor risks to make sure that there are no unintended, unwarranted risks accumulating in the portfolio. For instance, we recently noticed that the momentum factor was starting to contribute more to risk than we believe was warranted, and we've adjusted individual positions to bring it back into line. I should also mention that risk is built into our evaluation process of each stock, as it determines the rate at which we discount each company's cash flows and thus determines each company's intrinsic value.
Thank you for that. Graham, shifting to sell discipline for a moment, can you talk about what would compel you to sell a portfolio position?
Of course, thank you. Our sell discipline is the converse of our buy discipline. There are really five main reasons we have for selling a stock. Firstly, the stock performs well and approaches our price target. Secondly, a more attractive stock is identified. Thirdly, a lower assessment of fair value results from a downward reassessment of the risk-adjusted future prospects of the firm. Fourthly, the timeliness of the stock deteriorates, rendering it untimely. And lastly, the integrity of financial reporting becomes suspect. In the first and second scenario, we may be more likely to scale out of the position over time. In the third, fourth, or fifth scenario, the position is most likely to be eliminated in its entirety. I did want to mention that one of the more common reasons we do sell a stock is due to a deterioration of timeliness. Our timeliness metrics look to identify stocks with positive momentum in investor sentiment as evidence that a positive catalyst is at work. The metrics we use are an earnings estimate revision, predicted earnings surprise, insider trading activity, price trend analysis, and short interest analysis. All of these factors are back-tested, and consistent with that back-testing, stocks that have a poor timeliness consistently underperform their peers. And using this data, our weighting scheme penalizes significantly stocks with a negative timeliness. This way, we believe we are working hard to avoid the value traps, a name that could appear for a long time to be cheap and undervalued, but without that timely catalyst, as well as to eliminate or trim names in our portfolio that see a reduction in their timeliness rank.
Thanks for that. Going back up to 30,000 feet, MJ, thinking about the broader economic environment, the Fed has begun to ease rates. August CPI was about 2.9%. Tax policy and a trend towards deregulation are generally positive for business, but the shift in trade and tariff policy has caused some uncertainty. Where do you see the equity markets currently, and what is your outlook for the rest of 2025 and into 2026?
Right, Mark. Equity markets have been extraordinarily strong since the initial bearish reaction to the Liberation Day announcement earlier in the year. It hasn't all been irrational trading. You know, consumers and market participants have remained remarkably resilient in the face of the uncertainty that you described, and earnings and economic growth have come in better than had been expected, as the tariff implementation has been far less draconian than that first announcement. Now, the 10-year has come down a bit as the Fed has begun to ease, and the earnings outlook has improved a bit as well. But at these levels, the equity market valuation is well above historical norms, which is obviously a concern. Now, despite the valuation, the technical setup for the remainder of the year looks quite favorable, with the GDP forecasted to come in just below 4% for the fourth quarter, and earnings estimated to gain another 7% in the fourth quarter. The market now is really counting on the Fed. The biggest risk here is the delayed impact from the tariffs that were announced earlier and the implementation that has been so sporadic throughout the year. Next year will be the first full year effect, as well as the first full year effect of the labor market adjustment to lower immigration. So lots of cross currents, but given that we see full valuations at this point, multiple expansion for the market from here is not to be expected. So maybe the best estimate for the following year for 2026 is the earnings growth that's expected about 10%. That might be the best estimate.
That's a great summary. Ted, turning back to you, in recent years, a relatively small group of growth-oriented companies have dominated the large cap space. How has the value segment been impacted by these mega cap growth leaders?
Yes, I believe you're alluding to the Magnificent Seven, which we would actually expand to 8 or 9. Broadcom definitely deserves inclusion, and Oracle's getting there. But certainly the level of euphoria surrounding those names can impact the growth value balance and flows in the market. More directly, those companies' spending decisions, notably their massive CapEx increases in the quest for AI dominance, can impact suppliers like Cisco, which we own as a beneficiary of the trend. As for our portfolio, as very style-pure value investors, we're virtually always positioned with materially stronger value metrics than our value benchmark. We won't buy the triple-digit PE names, the Teslas of the world, but we can seek out cheaper exposure to some of the exciting high-growth megatrends. For example, 5 years ago, we bought Oracle on the thesis that the market was underestimating its prospects in cloud computing. While consensus was so concerned about the existing oligopoly of Amazon, Microsoft, and Google, it was our position that Oracle, in fact, had the best technology offering and should become a viable fourth competitor. The shares have quadrupled, and we finally eliminated our position in July. Another example is IBM, which we bought 3.5 years ago, partly due to its new mainframe cycle, but also as a very inexpensive call option on artificial intelligence and quantum computing. That one's doubled, working out well for us too. And while we don't traffic heavily in Magnificent Seven names, we're not against buying them if they dip into value territory. When we have owned even one, it's always been the cheapest and most undervalued. As it happens, three of them, namely Alphabet, Amazon, and Meta, came into our value benchmark at the end of June at a collective weight near 6%, and we redoubled our efforts to evaluate their company-specific factors. This deeper consideration revealed a solid investment case for Google, or Alphabet, easily the cheapest and most undervalued of the three, and with our timeliness model also suggesting there's reason for near-term optimism. Fortunately, it's risen 40% in that short time, and we've already begun trimming. This is our third foray into the Mag 7. We owned Google once before, from October 2020 to May 2022, with our thesis that the market was overestimating breakup risks and undervaluing its cloud opportunity and AI advantages. We overstayed our welcome a bit at the end, but it was still a nice outperformer. And finally, we owned Meta very early in 2023 when it was down about two-thirds from its prior peak. But after the proverbial knife had stopped falling and it had stopped screening as untimely. Our thesis was that it was in the midst of cycling through its worst advertising comparisons and was dialing back what we considered to be its highly questionable metaverse spending plan. So we expected investor sentiment to continue improving. It promptly went up 125% in 5.5 months before exiting the benchmark again, and we couldn't justify holding it any longer in a value portfolio. Given our very slight overweight to the stock, it didn't give us a lot of alpha, but it also didn't ruin our year by not owning it.
That's a great summary, Ted. I'm going to pivot back to you, Graham. Can you talk about how the large cap value strategy is currently positioned? Where you find the best opportunities to put new capital to work, either in sectors or subsectors, and maybe talk about any of the broader themes that are causing you to target certain areas.
Of course, yeah, thank you. As Ted sort of mentioned, around 70% of the active risk in the portfolio comes from our stock-specific risk, with concentrations in the financials, healthcare, and industrial sectors. Within the stock contributions themselves, Cummins, Delta Airlines, U.S. Bank Corp., and Mosaic have our highest stock-specific contributions. The remainder of the active risk derives from style and industry deviations from the benchmark. Among style effects, with an overexposure to earnings yield, dividend yield, and book-to-price, the portfolio maintains its positioning as deeper value characteristics than the benchmark. The portfolio also has an overexposure to the momentum factor at the moment, and with overweights to energy, healthcare, communication services, and financials, and underweights to industrials, information technology, consumer discretionary, and materials, the portfolio is positioned moderately defensively at the moment.
Thank you. After an extended period of underperformance, do you think that value-oriented stocks may be positioned with some potential advantage to outperform vis-a-vis their growth sisters?
Right. It's a good question, Mark. I mean, if we look back at the very long term, like back to 1927, value had a multi-decade, many decades of outperformance versus growth. And it wasn't until up till about 2007 when we hit the great financial crisis that the pendulum began to swing strongly the other way. And it has been an extended period where value has lagged growth. When we consider the outlook from here for value versus growth, we look at the Russell 1000 value versus the Russell 1000 growth on measures of statistical cheapness, valuation, and timeliness. Again, the same way that we look at stocks from the bottom up, we're looking at value versus growth in that way. Statistical cheapness measures currently favor value over growth. Measures of valuation favor value over growth, but timeliness metrics favor growth over value. So kind of a mixed bag there, but, you know, if indeed we do have a pause that refreshes, you know, if we have a recession in the early part of next year, value may indeed be poised to outperform given the more deeper ties to a cyclical rebound.
Thanks for that. MJ, your team applies a very disciplined approach to managing equity portfolios. How do you see a concentrated large cap value strategy like the McKee Large Cap Value portfolio being best positioned in the diversified portfolio of an investor?
Right, Mark. You know, as a result of the disciplined implementation of the approach that we've described here today, we do have a very long history of maintaining stronger value characteristics. And we do have a tendency to be deeper value than the benchmark and many of our peers. In other words, we stay in our style box and we tend to perform best when value is in favor. Because of those tendencies, our portfolio tends to be an excellent counterpart or complement to a disciplined large cap growth portfolio.
Thank you for that. MJ, Ted, Graham, thank you for joining me today. This has been a great discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to our North Square Active Insights podcast. For more information on North Square Investments, our partners, and investment solutions, please visit our website at www.northsquareinvest.com. Nothing contained in this communication constitutes tax, legal, or investment advice. Investors must consult their tax advisor or legal counsel for advice and information concerning their particular situation. This podcast contains certain statements that may include forward-looking statements. Although C.S. McKee believes that the expectations reflected in these forward-looking statements are reasonable, they do involve assumptions, risks, and uncertainties, and these expectations may prove to be incorrect. Actual events could differ materially from those anticipated in these forward-looking statements as a result of a variety of factors. You should not place undue reliance on these forward-looking statements. This podcast reflects C.S. McKee's views and opinions as of the date herein, which are subject to change at any time based on market and other conditions. We disclaim any responsibility to update these views. These views should not be relied on as investment advice or an indication of trading intention.